Okay, we'll get started now. Good afternoon, and welcome to Get Out and Write. My name is J.M. Reinbold, and I'm the director of the Written Remains Writers Guild. Before we start, I'd like to go over today's schedule, the free write guidelines, and a couple other items. You have some handouts in front of you. One is our schedule for today. That's the white sheet, and that'll tell you we're starting a little late, and I'm sorry about that, but
we got here, right?
We're going to do our best to keep to the schedule. The pink sheet that you have is the guidelines for the free writes. You can look at that real quick, and that will... I'm going through this real quickly so we can get started. If you'll just look over the pink sheet real quickly, that'll give you the guidelines. And the kind of ivory-colored sheet of paper is events from the Written Remains Writers Guild that are current and upcoming events, and you can check that out at your leisure. You have name tags in front of you. If you put those on, that would be great. And I have a email sign-up here if you would like to be on our mailing list. You're already on the list. You don't need to sign unless you have a new email address. And now I'd like to introduce our featured author, Justin Time. Justin is a Buddhist, a Dadaist, and a multi-talented experimental artist. He is currently the director of a Radioactive Mango Recordings All Out Monster Revolt Project, a member of the Written Remains Writers Guild, and steward of the Dada Network. Justin has been a longtime fellow in many experimental arts organizations, most notably the New Absurdist, 391, the Dada Network, and Taped Rugs Productions. Justin's work has appeared in both national and international publications, most notably K. Boo's 101 Hours of Innumerable Small Events, the Written Remains Writers Guild First Anthology Stories from the Ink Slingers, Full of Crows Corporeal Flux 2, Millstream Books Bust Down the Door and Eat All the Chickens, and Three Room Press's premier Dada magazine, Maintenant. Justin is the founder and director of America's most obscure absurdist comedy troupe, The Whimsical Icebox, the curator of the Omphalos Dada Yao's Digital Dada Museum, and the founder of the annual international event, Dolly Crab Day. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out today. Had to bear with me. Everything wasn't written in a hurry, but it took a long time to define how to do a giant monster story. So I just put it down and categorized it the best I could. But everything I'm going to talk about is on the paperwork. So if I tend to ramble, then you can just follow the paperwork and tell me to shut up, and I'll be all right. But a little bit about myself. Primarily, I'm an experimental writer, which is a style that encompasses many other genres like absurdism, dadaism, surrealism, weirdism, and nonsense. It's a dualistic process where I not only attack the content, but also the context in which it is written. So that's why sometimes it could be nonsense. But for years, I've had a growing desire to work with giant monsters. I've been a fan since childhood. Just last year, I had this crazy desire to be a mad scientist and just start creating giant monsters. But if I was going to enter the genre, I wanted to leave it better than it is. So I was going to try to enhance the quality of the story, because over the years, since it kind of climaxed in the 50s. It was in comic books and magazines and radio plays and movies. And ever since then, it's been going downhill and just been used for novelty, more or less, to help boost sales, but not really addressed in any serious way. So the whole reason for starting the All Out Monster Revolt was to create original giant monster stories that exhibit greater thrills and chills, but with the same flair of the fantastic that the original pulp magazines had, where the giant monster genre began, eliciting compelling collections of bold stories by writers who integrate the giant monster mythos into their own imagination and own style to create truly unique stories, both in approach and in handling, but always keeping within the Asian tradition of where the monster is the star. So you don't see that too much. Most of the time, the monsters are interchangeable with natural disasters or something like take movie Twister, for example. If you just put a giant monster in there the way they currently write such things, there wouldn't be that much difference. So this the project is all about giving the monster his identity, or her identity, depending on the gender of the monster, or it. Where it all began, it's originally started probably even farther back with Neanderthal people, but mythology were strange tales of bizarre and colossal creatures from foreign lands that were passed along from generation to generation and believed to be true, and that these giant monsters were always on the cusp of climbing out of the darkness and getting the people. And that's why the mythology has lasted so long. And in the pulp days, mythology is where the legend of the giant monsters were born. And in the 20s through the 40s, when the pulp magazine was really a big thing, the writers took in tandem both new discoveries of their time and the persistent unknown, and let their ingenuity run wild with this information. Using speculation, prognostication, and a fertile imagination, they spun amazing stories about giant monsters, and which is where the giant monster genre began. Now today, even though giant monsters are still around, almost around every corner, but they have lost, through no fault of their own, the respect they so richly deserve. Although they have been relegated to the realm of novelty, they are considered popular enough to boost sales, but not great enough to warrant independent activities, which is a trend that's changing with Pacific Rim and the new Godzilla that's coming out next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And if,
excuse me, what country is that in?
Japan does Godzilla. Well, actually, it's American, but Japan is the one that created it, founded it, and did the bulk of the mythos for it.
One of my favorite movies, I just had it on and I'm not lying, is Godzilla in New York.
Oh, okay.
That one is with Gene Reno. That one is fantastic. I must have seen it 10 times.
It is a good movie, although it's technically not a Godzilla movie because they didn't follow any of the precepts that Japan had set up. It was actually probably a better remake of The Beast from 2000 Fathoms, if you've seen that. Because it's almost identical. All right, so now, creation of a myth. When you're working with giant monsters, you have a lot of bad publicity already, because so many people have maltreated the genre and not embellished or put a lot of effort into creating something that was lasting, something of much substance. When you're working with giant monsters, you have to do a number of things to really break out of the stereotype that giant monsters are into now, or a part of, I should say. The trick is to find something that people are already leery of and suspicious of. And, you know, I suppose it could still be, you know, working with nuclear material, because that has produced malformations and strange things, but so far, nature has produced more giant monsters than radioactivity has. But it can, with working with giant monsters too, you can actually use any kind of, it's hard to say, because since there's so much, I don't know if you want to say truth in the media and the news and stuff, but you certainly know a lot of more about the different things that they're working on. But I think some of the things that are still not quite sitting right with cloning and stuff like that, you know, because they're working with that, and they're already setting up precepts where you can't do this and you can't do that because it's, you know, going beyond what they're comfortable with doing. So imagine if somebody would, you know, go far beyond what they're already doing. And maybe there is. I mean, way back when it first came out, people were already cloning sheep already. And that's before they even really considered what was possible with cloning. So other than that, I don't know, other than nature, which is the most mysterious creator of all, people in general influence more of what's going on. Because just by how we're doing with pollution and stuff like that, there's already, like, say, in in between Japan and China, in that sea there are giant squids, not squids, jellyfish, that are starting to appear in great hordes. And they've proven now that the giant colossal squid does exist. It's probably not as long as, 300-400 feet, like some of the nautical tales went, but it's out there. You know, and people are pretty sure that Nessie is real, although there's no conclusive evidence, but they're still looking. So there is still some mystery out in the world. With the news and everything, takes us into the next section, is using a bit of brilliance to create your giant monster, to use as an impetus for your story. Because it's always great taking a piece of real information and then building a whole fictional account around it. So I guess that's where I will play something. Archilover's radio play back in the 1930s, where he produced a radio play called Chicken Heart. It's a legendary episode because a lot of people know about it. It's a funny thing, too, because it's only not even 10 minutes long. And it's still an amazing example of what the power of radio theater can do. And so without further ado, I guess I will play that. Now, it's pretty wild, so be prepared for it.
Do you remember some time ago in an Eastern scientific institution, they kept a piece of heart alive for weeks on end? Well, I got to thinking, what if that heart began to grow? And grow, and grow, and grow.
Still growing. No, Chief, I tell you the truth, the corridor's choked with living, crawling flesh. No, I'm not drunk, I'm telling you the truth. That little piece of flesh is growing until now, it's jamming that building, all inside the space of an hour. You've got to believe me, it's the greatest news story of the generation, and here you argue with me. I tell you it's the truth, you've got to believe
me. Believe me, I tell you the only hope is to burn the building to the ground at once.
Now, wait a minute, Doc, wait a minute. Take it.
I tell you, burn it to the ground.
Fine, I tell you, take it easy. I sent it a call.
No, don't you understand? For some reason, I cannot even imagine. This tissue is doubling in size every hour. You know what that means? In another hour, it will be twice the size it is now. And long before that, it will break open the building with the force of its breath. And then it will be free in the street. Do you hear me? Free in the street. And then those tentacles of protoplasm stretching out to feed on anything they can reach.
Jackie! See the walls! Jackie! I want you!
Passing hour, its growth is doubling. Do you know what that means?
If it is now one block in size, within 30 hours that cannibal flesh will have increased in size to one square block to the 30th power. In 30 hours, every inch of this whole city will be crushed under that moving flesh. Within 60 hours, it will have covered the entire state. Within 2 weeks, the entire United States. You ask for the National Guard. I say, call out the entire army. Blast it from up there.
Flood that thing with water from all angles.
All right, here's a signal. Open them up! Full blast! Chief, look out! That's fast! It's reaching out! Get back, everybody! Everybody, back!
The fools, what good is water? I told them. The only hope is artillery. Bomb.
All National Guardsmen, report to your armies. All National Guardsmen, report to your armies.
Battery in position, sir.
Commence firing on the hour.
Yes, sir.
10, 9, 0.
We couldn't have taken off. That blasted protoplasm, or whatever it is, was sucking at the wheels by the time we left the ground.
Yes, I saw.
5,000 feet. Well, we'll cruise around up there for a few minutes and then head west.
It will do no good.
You can't mean it. It must stop growing sometime. It must.
Look at it down there. The gray blankets of evil covering everything. See how the roads are black with men and women and their children running for their lives. See how the protoplasmic gray reaches out and engulfs them. See?
Stop it! Stop talking like that! We'll get away! The government, they'll send bombing planes, poison gas.
No hope. Listen to me, Lewis. You remember only a handful of days ago you asked me my prophecy at the end of the earth? You remember my answer? Oh, such a scholarly prophecy. Cessation of earth rotation. Mighty sounding astronomical theories. But now this is reality, Lewis. The end has come for humanity, not in the red of atomic fusion, not in the glory of interstellar combustion, not in the peace of white, cold silence, but with that creeping, grasping flesh below us. It is a joke, hey, Lewis, a great joke, the joke of the cosmos, the end of mankind.
Why?
Because the chickens are...
No, we won't die, I can't die. I'll find a safe landing somewhere, I'll find a place... Lord, it's cow! We're in a spin! I can't get out of it!
I told you, doomed!
No! No!
For all mankind, doomed!
No! We're falling right into it, into the heart!
Okay. Well, that story about sums up everything that I'm talking about. I mean, it's a little faster paced than most radio stories from the time. And it's one of the few stories, actually, that has the monster win out and destroy the world. And that's all in about 7.5 minutes. So you have much more to work with, but that is probably, so far, the best of its kind. So it's a good template to follow. So how am I doing on time? Is it time for the prompts now?
No.
10 minutes. All right. Well, let's see here. What's okay? Well, one of the most important things is if you're going to write a giant monster story, then write a story about a giant monster. Most people say, "I'm going to write a giant monster story," and it's all about the human experience, and the giant monster is just a small part of the story. Like I read one. Story in a collection I have from a fella who's supposed to be, you know, a really good proponent of giant monster stories. And his story, which was in a giant monster anthology, actually really only mentioned the giant monster obliquely. It was more about the twisted relationship between these three criminals and this treasure that's at the bottom of a natural spring lake. And it didn't talk about the monster at all. Didn't even give a description of what it just said, that it was lurking in the dark. And while sometimes that works, people who read giant monster stories read them for one reason only, and that's for the giant monster. So you have an obligation, if you're writing a giant monster story, to write a story about a giant monster. When people actually write stories about a giant monster, it's hard to relate to a giant monster because it's so big, especially a monster like Godzilla, who's 500 feet tall. Not many of us can relate to something like that, but if you consider that to insects, we're about 500 feet tall. So next time a fly comes into the room and it's bothering you and you're trying to swat it, just try to look at it from the fly's point of view, because you're a hideously tall giant monster and you're trying to squash it because it's doing whatever it's doing. So when you write your story, consider that perspective. Like when you're walking through the yard and you see, you know, grasshoppers and other insects jumping out of the way when they see you coming, or how many you're actually squashing as you're walking by without even knowing it. Think about those things too while you're writing a giant monster story. Okay, and I guess for the last few minutes I'll talk about endings. Now, the endings of giant monster stories are the biggest hurdle you have to get over, because Hollywood has set up this precedence that actually started all the way back with King Kong in 1933, that the monster has to die at the end of the film or story. It's not 100% that way, but to make a really good giant monster story, you have to go beyond the stereotype and figure out a way that your monster stays alive, but also is no longer a threat to the human race. So, like, say, for example, the Gamera movie. I don't know why they tried to destroy him with bombs and stuff like that, and they couldn't do it, so they built this rocket ship that was even more enormous than Gamera, stuck him in it, and shot him out into outer space. So that's how they got rid of him. Of course, he hit a comet, the rocket ship opened up, and he flew back to Earth. But luckily for mankind, Gamera was a friend of children and a friend of the Earth, so he stayed out of our business as long as no giant monsters came around to come into his territory. Now, Godzilla, on the other hand, is an anti-hero. You can't quite read him. He comes to protect people, I suppose, from other giant monsters, but he does a hell of a lot of damage while he's doing it. And he makes no qualms about getting mad and blowing up buildings and wiping people out. But actually, Toho, they destroyed Godzilla in the first movie. But, of course, corporate financing and where the money comes from, they realized they would make more money by keeping him alive. So they started a precedence for the monster winning and, you know, retreating back to wherever he came from. That in itself is what they do is limited, because he wins his battle and then he triumphantly walks back to Monster Island or wherever he stays most of the time. So what you have as a modern writer of monster stories is to go beyond what they've set up and use your imagination to the fullest and create a alternate ending for your giant monster stories. So, like I said, where the monster somehow stays alive but is no longer a threat. Or maybe he continues to stay a threat and he just marauds around the world 24/7, wiping stuff out. So, however you're going to do it. What I've written down is a general tips, tricks, and things to think about while you're writing your giant monster story so you can go beyond what is today's norm. So, I think that it? Okay, I'll take some questions. I might not be able to answer them, but I do my best. So.
Can you talk about your development of the monster as a character? Because my feelings of this genre, in watching the movies, was some people running, and that's all I know about giant monsters. What are some of the things you would define in the paradigm of monster as a character?
Well, according to giant monster fans, King Kong from 1933 is probably the quintessential giant monster movie. I would say, and also in more recently in the 90s, the Gamera trilogy, Gamera Guardian of the Universe, Gamera versus Legion, and The Revenge of Iris are probably the three best films in the giant monster genre, because they address the guy who wrote it. His name escapes me. I think I was supposed to put notes in here, but I didn't do that. He set out to write the best giant monster movie he could. I don't know how long it took him, but he really did a fantastic job. So if you're going to watch any movies, those three, King Kong, I'm not sure about Pacific Rim. I have not seen that yet. I hear it's good, but I can't comment on that.
Is that the movie you could get on TV?
Which one?
The last one, Pacific.
Pacific, yeah. Yeah, it just came out as DVD. It's like $44.
How do you spell it?
Pacific Rim, just like...
R-I-M.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
I guess it'll be on demand, because they... If you have Comcast, because they... Same day as DVD release, I think they put stuff out. I'm not sure. But, yes.
Is the Kraken a giant monster? You know, release the Kraken.
Oh, from the Clash of the Titans? Yes.
I always wondered about the Kraken.
Yes. I think Ray Harryhausen's was much more interesting back in the 60s, I guess it was. But the remake recently, I think that Kraken was a lot more indicative of the Daikaiju that's been of recent years, and a lot more scary, I think. So the original was more awesome inspiring, because it was this huge thing that just came out of... Of course, you know, with claymation, they couldn't do much, so he just, you know... But... That's also what you have to do with your stories, too, is that you have infinite possibilities, and you can really embellish on how the monster responds to conflict and attacks and such things. Because most monsters that are in the movies are animals, and animals, if you watch the stuff on the what used to be the better Animal Planet, like Bug Wars and Monster Insects, something like that, they are really, they're pretty scrappy fighters. And it's really unfortunate that movies don't really handle that much. Because I think Spiders, which came out last year, had rather large spiders like this who got around and did more. But their giant spider that was, I don't know, about 200 feet tall, all they did was they had it break up out of the street, which is pretty impressive. And then just walk around town while the military bombed the crap out of it until they killed it. And for a giant monster, that's really... He must have been sick or something, because they can, you know... If you see insects in particular, they're pretty vicious. And most animals will fight when there's impending doom. You know, they'll fight like there's no tomorrow. So you have to take that into account when you're writing your stories. Yes?
I have a question about... The giant monster that I thought of was the plant from Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh yes, Audrey too.
She actually does get destroyed, but leaves a little baby behind. And then there's a book, Grendel. I can't remember who it's by, but it's from the point of view of the monster from Beowulf. So my question is, with the chicken heart story, how important is it to give it an explanation? If it's nature that's doing it, that's one thing. But somehow or other this chicken heart starts growing. So do you have to kind of explain why?
Well, right now there's two schools of thought. It's a mystery and the scientific explanation. Really, both of them are hard to swallow. Because science really hasn't progressed. Now, I don't know if anybody... I think that I just heard they've started growing really enormous vegetables, you know, to help alleviate world famine and be easier on the land and everything. But I always preferred the mystery side of things, because in these days you don't have a lot of that. We're poking our nose in just about every aspect. And there's no more places where people don't go, or, you know, we don't know what's, except for the ocean, you know. We can even go, we can go down further now than we have before, and guess what? We found a giant squid. So who knows what's all the way down there. But the scientific explanation is really hard because you have to know your science. Because if you're going to go that route, you have to be plausible. Even if you're sticking it together, you have to make it sound like, and I say that in one of the sections, it has to be something that people don't know everything about. So you still have that element of unknown in it. You know, so if something drastically goes wrong, then you have yourself a giant mutation. So it's very hard. Both are very hard. And usually the mysterious unexplained is a lot easier because you just say, oh my God, where did it come from? And that's, I like that because it establishes, you know, yes, we don't know everything. So there are still places out there that don't want us to be there. So I hope that answers your question. So, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how writers have shown aspects of the giant monster's personality? Like I'm thinking about the baby Godzilla that's in some movies.
Yeah, either Minya or... They call it baby Godzilla.
Friends with a little boy and then because of that relationship, the little boy takes him and then Godzilla sees him and we see a kind of exchange. How have other authors done similar things to show personality?
Well, I would like to point out that in the giant monster genre, baby Godzilla is probably one of the most hated monsters that there ever was. Because, it, you know, you have Godzilla who's no-nonsense, a badass, and then you have baby Godzilla who's...
cute.
Yeah, cute, goofy, and that's, I think that's good. I think there should be that in stories. Because a lot of fairy tales, they're actually kind of scary, so you should call them scary tales, but they have giant monsters that are, you know, more geared to chill. Like Puff the Magic Dragon was a giant monster. If I remember correctly, it was make-believe, but still, it was funny and goofy, and that was a lasting story that stuck with people for a long time. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the children's anime movie, Totoro? Which was this big creature? I'm not really sure it is a monster.
I'll have to look into it. I don't read Japanese, so it's very hard for me to do the research on...
It's a movie.
Okay, well, I haven't seen it either, so...
It's a big giant. I think it might be a cat. But it's very positive. So what I'm wondering about is the word monster. Does it have to be negative or can it just mean a big creature?
Totoro means troll in Japanese. So basically he's a giant troll.
Trolls are nasty though.
But he's friendly. He appears to help the children through a difficult time and then at the end of the movie they don't need him anymore.
Okay, kind of like Gamera, actually. Well, from the original run. Monster is a phrase for anything that is, you know, scary or hideous or large, or the actual Japanese term they use is either kaiju or daikaiju, which means strange beast. So I suppose you can use that kind of categorizing like that.
Yeah. So in the giant monster genre, the monster can be in a vaporous form or a contagion form. We're talking about a physically giant monster.
Well, you have the Blob, who was a gelatinous, morphic thing. Though, if you're going to write a story about something that has no physical substance, The Forbidden Planet, I think it was, which it had a manifestation of what they call the id, or the subconscious of man. I haven't seen that recently, so I can't really comment on how well they did it. But you'll have to do a lot more legwork to give that type of monster substance because you have less to work with. So, there was actually I don't have it with me, but there was actually another Arch Obler play called The Dark. I could send that to you and you can, it doesn't go to the incredible sizes, but it's...
There was a movie several years ago that was about the rumblings under New York City and the whole day, the drama in New York City, and you never found out what was. I can't remember the name, but it was a really popular movie. All day there was damage from whatever was rumbling under the earth and then it...
Talking about Cloverfield, are you?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay, well...
That's not a monster.
That's a monster.
That is a monster.
That's a monster.
So that is a monster even though we never see...
Now, I like different movies for different aspects. Now, I'm not really... I like the point of view from following as they're going through the tunnels and all that stuff. But as a giant monster film, it was really a letdown because, you know, there wasn't enough of the monster. You saw it do impressive things, like knock the head off of the Statue of Liberty and, you know, bust through buildings. And you just see glimpses of it, you know, from people who are watching it, passing through, you know, just little frames of it. And you kind of see it at the end, but at least for a giant monster movie, it's not enough. You know, people want to read about the giant monster, want to see the images, because they want to be, you have to shock them. They want to be scared, or they want to be...
More detail.
Yeah. Want to be astounded by what is possible.
I think that the movie Tremors, without the giant part...
Yeah, that was pretty good.
But you never saw anything from the world's point of view.
No. No.
I don't know if there's an explanation about how they came to be known.
Well, I've only seen it once, and I don't retain too much if I've seen it once, but I think they did three movies, and then there was a prequel that they made after all those, which was back in the cowboy days, which I think is like 1800s or something. And I think they said it came from outer space or something. I can't remember, so I don't really comment on that. But a lot of movies have a lot of good aspects, but not many can combine all those into one. Yeah.
How do you define a giant monster? Does it have to just be taller than it, or is there a specific height that qualifies it as a giant monster?
Well, that's kind of a rough spot for me, because it's kind of a rough spot for me because I like 200, 400 foot tall monsters, but King Kong was only 50 feet, so that's still big enough for a person to sit in his hand, so that's scary enough. So when you have, like, what was it, eight-legged freaks, I think it was, where the spiders were about 6 feet high, and that's pretty scary. So it's really, I should say, that is based on what you like or what you want to work with.
Because on the way over here I was thinking of Thumbelina, cause that's my thing. I'm fairy tales. That's what I normally go to. So I'm thinking that to Thumbelina, even a normal person would be considered a giant monster. So would that story qualify as a giant monster story?
I will say yes, but it's from a different perspective.
But would they have to be cruel to her? Because they are not friendly.
Well, it depends on it. Well, let me answer that one first. Is monsters do not have to be vicious or mean-spirited, like Gamera. He's a friend of children. And actually, I would say if you really like a heartwarming movie about a giant monster, watch Gamera 4 called Gamera the Brave. It makes me cry every time because it's the first time you see Gamera start out as a little turtle. And he's adopted by a young boy. And, you know, and right off the bat, the kid goes to sleep, wakes up, turtles twice the size he was when he went to sleep. And then he starts flying, and then he's breathing fire. But he's still this adorable little thing. But the movie that makes it endearing is that it really shows the vulnerable side of monsters, because as they called him Toto, because that was his dead mother's nickname for him, so he called his turtle Toto. So, and he didn't like the fact that Toto was going to grow up to be, what do you thought, a giant monster that does terrible things. And like the prequel that they did before the film, see, Gamera was genetically made by the Atlanteans to protect against the Gauss, who were insatiable meat-eating pterodactyl-like birds. So anyway, there's a number of Gameras. So in the beginning of this film, the Gamera that existed in the 1970s got into a situation where the Gauss were overpowering him and becoming a real threat to human civilization because they would just fly around and just wipe out everything. So he sacrificed himself by blowing himself up and killing the Gauss. And that plays into the rest of the movie because he becomes, you know, if somebody sacrifices themselves for you, that is a major, that's almost a saint. So, and they really kind of address that in the film. But as he's growing up, he is certainly not the Gamera that came before him. And he's not even really full size. And when a giant monster, Zadeus, I think they called him, comes to, you know, feast on people. So he's not ready, but he takes on this monster who's much larger, much fiercer, and has been in the business a lot longer than Toto has. But he goes out and he tries to fight this monster himself to great cost. And it turns out that when the boy found the little turtle, he was on a piece of, I don't know, they don't really, at least in the American dub, they don't describe what it is, but it is a magical stone kind of base that he's, that the egg is on. And he needs that to reach his full potential. And of course, he's off fighting the giant monster, and this thing he needs is somewhere lost in, well, not lost in the city, but it's with a friend of the boy's. And so the endearing part of this movie is that children who have been prominently friends of Gamera just know that he needs this to win this fight with this monster. So in the face of chaos where people are just fleeing in every direction and there's chaos and there's buildings coming down, these tiny children between 5 and 10 years old are running back toward the destruction, towards the fighting, to one by one passing this magical stone from child to child until it gets to the original Toto boy. And he takes it to Gamera, but he has this long discussion, you know, don't blow yourself up. I don't want you to die. Don't blow up. And that's what makes it endearing, because these children are just, they just know that Gamera is there to help them, and they at great risk, they run into danger carrying the stone, and they go as far as they possibly can, and then another child shows up to continue the, see, I'm even getting a little weepy just talking about it. So that's a good movie for the positive side of monsters. Yes.
How do you spell Gamera, please?
G-A-M-E-R-A.
E-R-A.
Yeah. Okay, so the prompts. Do you think I should start with the audio one or the paper one? Okay. In the handout I gave you, there is a article. It's the third to last page. And I'll read it, so, but you can glance over it. I only gave you the first page. They wrote other things, but the priority, what we're dealing with, is what's under here. So the title is it a bird, a plane, a UFO? It's a red sprite. Dubbed red sprites by researchers, these dancing fairies of the clouds are something glimpsed as blood-red bursts of light in the shape of jellyfish. At other times, they appear as trumpet-shaped blue emissions, called blue jets. Like most elusive nymphs, however, red sprites and blue jets come out on only one occasion during severe thunderstorms. Although sporadically reported for years by airline pilots, only in the past decade or two has there been enough evidence to convince atmospheric scientists to investigate this phenomenon. So, my prompt for you is, what could this possibly be in the context of a giant monster?
20 minutes?
You got 20 minutes. Okay. All right. So I guess if there's nobody else who wants to read, then I will move on to the next prompt, which is an audio prompt. Now, I don't expect, this is a trailer for a film, but I think it's a fantastic trailer to a pitiful movie. So I wanted to play it for you, and I'm not asking for a synopsis or anything like that, but just take the idea and see what you can come up with and write scenes. It doesn't matter. Anything would be better than how this movie actually turned out. So
don't connect it in any way to what we just did.
You can if you want to. You listen to it and you decide.
They floated like giants in the dark mystery of time and space, unholy overlords with their fiendish diabolical mind machine. Fantastic invasion of planet Earth, a mind-bending voyage in 3D. Fantastic invasion of planet Earth, a thrilling science fiction adventure in widescreen 3D space vision. Fantastic invasion of planet Earth, rated PG. Don't miss it.
Okay, off you go.
That's the whole thing.
Yes. It's not as long as the other one.
20 minutes.
There was actually a movie, I haven't seen it, but I've seen bits about it that was also food-based called, I think it was called Invasion of the Giant Moussaka. So, that's interesting. Right. Okay, well, that's it for me. The only other thing I have to say is there's three things you need for writing a giant monster story. You need imagination, dedication, and the third thing is up to you. So, and the last little thing to think about is when you leave today, look up at the clouds and just imagine if one of those was just some giant monster just floating by, just as it moves, with your gaseous type of monster. And I thank you for letting me talk to you for a while. Thank you. Thank you so much. And if you want to, in the handout, I have information on the magazine that we put out, a mashup radio play, and a music show. But if you want to send me your bits of writing, I'll put it in the next issue of the magazine, if you would like to do that.
And Justin has some of his publishing.
Oh, yes, if you want to buy some of my crap, it's up here.
CDs,
half price today.
If you're interested.
It's the experimental stuff, not the giant monster stuff. So.